Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about opening your eyes to a new view of life. I'm glad you joined us today. You know, each day we live, we have a series of choices of where we spend our time, what to think, and how to go about our day. And some people choose to fill the gaps in their day with worthwhile things like uplifting podcasts. This podcast is born from a deep desire to help us all live a happier life, and the firm belief that a powerful way to make that happen is to open our eyes to new ways of seeing life. So, hopefully today, in this time together, we'll get a new perspective of how to think and live better. And if you like this podcast, please share it with a friend. It just may be what they need in their life today. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to talk about your soul purpose. When I was a young man, my friends and I would often spend winter afternoons in the mountains on a ski hill. There were several to choose from near my home, and we found our way to most of them. Skiing with friends was a contest. We would follow the leader who would take us off trail or down the steepest slopes or in between the trees, and if he jumped off a ledge, everyone that followed would do the same. On Friday nights, we would run to the theater. Why? Because the Warren Miller ski movies were playing. Miller, who grew up in California, fell in love with skiing, surfing, and photography, and started making surfing and skiing films. He would follow some of the world's most famous skiers, and those skiers would tackle some of the biggest mountains imaginable, and he would capture this on film. Miller's movies would show daredevil feats and put them to music and use his narrative and humor to take us on a journey with these skiers and snowboarders, making me and my friends wish that we could become daredevils like these amazing skiers. The next day, we would head back to the mountain and we would pretend we were skiing in a Warren Miller ski movie. Well, one of the most famous experts Miller featured in his movies was the Michael Jordan of snowboarding. His name was Craig Kelly. Kelly attended Mount Vernon High School in Washington and then the University of Washington, but never graduated because the mountains were calling. He was a natural in the snow. When he would snowboard the deepest slopes and longest runs, it was like an artist surfing along the white canvas with beauty and grace, leaving a spray of snow dust trailing behind him. He was called the Style Master, and he literally shaped the snowboarding sport by himself. The Burton snowboards he designed were called the Mystery Air, the CK Slope Style, the Cascade, and the Omen. Jake Burton was quoted as saying, "When I started listening to Craig Kelly, that was when my company became successful and really took off." Adding that, "When the rest of the industry listened to Craig, that was when the sport really took off." Well, Kelly was a four-time world snowboarding champion and three-time U.S. champion, and the recipient of snowboarding's Lifetime Achievement Award. He was sponsored by the big snowboarding companies of the day like Sims and Burton. In one Warren Miller movie, Miller dedicates a special segment to Kelly called Journey to Honor. Why? Because of what happened in 2003 when Kelly was 36. At the time, Kelly was the first certified snowboarder certified by the Canadian Avalanche Association. He and 24 other skiers jumped aboard a helicopter to ski a remote mountain slope near Revelstoke, British Columbia, about 400 miles east of Vancouver. The outing was organized by Selkirk Mountain Experience and led by a well-known guide, Rudy Bellinger. Some of the skiers carried beacons for use in an avalanche emergency. Well, the group split into two, one going higher on the mountain than the other. As the skiers above were skiing across the 35-degree slope, suddenly, a thunderous roar echoed throughout the surrounding mountains, and a 100-foot-wide tide of snow suddenly dropped with a loud swoop and swept the skiers higher on the mountain off their skis. Immediately, they knew it was an avalanche and was going to be a big slide. Nothing about the mountain that day suggested an avalanche was possible. Even the experts had forecasted the avalanche danger was low. The guide and Craig Kelly both had agreed with the forecast. Well, avalanches happen in two forms. Slab avalanches, in which the top layer or slab of snow is triggered to slide on top of a weaker snow layer, and loose snow avalanches made of looser snow through the top layer. After being set off, avalanches usually accelerate rapidly and grow in mass and volume as they capture more and more snow as they slide down the mountain. Typically, avalanches are triggered by weather, such as increased snowfall, but artificial triggers can include skiers, snowmobiles, or controlled explosives. Well, on this day in Revelstoke, when the skiers heard the loud thump and felt the snow move under their feet, several of them atop the mountain slope knew to kick off their skis, and they immediately tried to swim in the snow, trying to stay close to the surface and not let the massive 100-foot-wide and 300-foot-long slab of tumbling snow pull them under. 8 of the 11 group of skiers lower on the mountain were buried by the weight of the slide. 3 were able to break free and keep their head above the snow. "It's like being in white water until it stops, and then it's like being in concrete," said John Siebert, a member of the ski party. "It's almost impossible to move once you're caught in an avalanche." When the snow settled, the 3 skiers below, who were not buried, worked to pull their legs and feet from the concrete-like packed snow. It took one skier almost 20 minutes to dig himself out. But as soon as they were free, they started a fervent search to locate their friends and dig them out. Several of those buried in the snow had beacons signaling their location, but digging down to find them before they suffocated was the challenge. When the snow is packed by an avalanche, it is almost impossible to dig others out without the best shovels and tools. One avalanche survivor described her experience like this: "When I stopped rolling in the snow, everything stopped. I was screaming for help, but trying not to use up too much oxygen. My phone was going off, but my arms were trapped so I couldn't answer. It was horrible, lying there and not being able to move, nobody knowing where I was or having any way of finding me. I was slowly suffocating, but fighting it off, trying to stay conscious." In our training as ski reps, we've been told that if someone is buried in an avalanche, after about 11 minutes, you're looking for a corpse. That was the most traumatic part. There wasn't one thing I could do to save myself. I was trying not to panic, but I did think, this is it. Well, for her, no one had avalanche gear, no probes, no shovels to dig them out, so the boys were just sticking their hands in the snow. After about 15 minutes, by pure chance, one of the boys hit the back of her leg. And when they pulled her out, they couldn't find a pulse. She wasn't breathing, so they started to give her CPR. She said, "When I woke, my friend was hugging me and kissing me." Well, that day in Revelstoke, none of those buried were found alive. One of the reasons is some were all 12 to 15 feet below the surface, and the avalanche was too strong. There was no escape. A paramedic who helped recover the victims told the reporters that when he arrived at the scene, the avalanche was packed solid. Later, the cause of death was determined to be asphyxiation. There were no traumatic injuries on any of the victims. And among the victims was the Michael Jordan of snowboarding, Craig Kelly. Craig was dug from the snow an hour after the avalanche happened. He was found head down and feet up in the snow, and there were no signs of injury. Well, Kelly paved the way for amazing snowboarders that would follow him. Shaun White is one of them. Shaun is a 5-time Olympian, 3-time gold medalist, the most by any snowboarder. And Shaun said this: "Some people attach snowboards to their feet. Very few attach them to their soul." Well, after reading about Craig and Shaun, I ended my reading thinking that these two professionals, one of which was my hero as a young man, attached snowboarding to their souls. And I wondered, what do I have attached to my soul? And what do they mean by this? Is it that something has to become a part of me? Or is it more than that? Well, first, let's consider the concept of a soul, because maybe we all don't understand what a soul is. And if we do, then do we believe we have a soul? Here are the words of one author: "We use the word soul so much you would think that we would have a handle on it. We talk of beautiful souls, lost souls, soul food, soul mates. And yet the more we talk, the more we risk of falling into cachet. There's an easy sentimentality to someone being soulful, for instance, or the way we refer to someone else by saying, 'Ah, but she's a good soul.' There's the title of the books, 'Chicken Soup for the Soul.' Descartes, for instance, said, "I think, therefore I am." And he was convinced that the soul was a physical entity embedded in the center of our brain. And a Massachusetts country doctor once claimed to weigh the soul as it left the body at death. The amount? 21 grams. In fact, whole bodies are often thought of as souls, or rather that the body was incidental and the soul was all that mattered. "Not a soul was left in sight" is often used when no one is present, or "souls that were lost at sea," or the emergency call SOS, "save our souls." Whatever vernacular formed over time, or the measurement of the weight of the soul, or the belief about how our soul resides, I'm convinced that we do, in fact, have a soul. Some people claim it is the soul that existed for a long time before it was placed into our bodies, and will exist long after our bodies return to the dust that gave it. Therefore, much of this life is about educating the soul, finding the soul's purpose for which we are living now, and using the experiences unique to those we can only gain with a body: hunger, pain, joy, a hug, the touch of a hand, the need to have discipline, are all things that a life with a body brings to educate your soul. These are things the soul would never know without such experiences. And many believe it is the soul that will continue after this life, and as such, the soul is who we are after this life. Therefore, our identity is found in our soul. And in some religions, the ultimate redemption of the soul is when the soul is reunited with an immortal body, inseparably connected and able to experience true joy. Well, regardless of what you believe, if we have a soul, and let's say we do, and it is core to our essence, who we really are, then wouldn't educating your soul, finding its purpose, improving your soul, be important to your life's quest? And is feeding your soul something different than feeding your mind or body? Have you ever felt an experience in which you felt like you were feeding your soul? You know, a friend of mine recently sent me an email, and the email contained a link to acquire Singing a Song with lyrics that I've heard before. The arrangement was new, and the voices and videos showing those singing was captivating. As I listened to the music and considered the lyrics and my love for the subject of those lyrics, I felt my soul lift. It was as if I was feeding my soul. I felt peace about it. And as I record this message, we're still in late spring where I live. When I start to see the glimpses of something I haven't seen since October, the sun, green, flowers, warmth, something happens to me, and I think to my soul. As the sun enters into my window earlier than it has during the dark winter, and I sit outside and feel the warmth of the sun going through me, it welcomes me to a new world and gives me a hope for things to come. It gives me joy, and I feel it in my body and soul. No doubt you've had similar moments in your life, but I think Shaun White had it right, that some people attach snowboards to their feet, but very few attach them to their souls. And for you and me, we may not be attaching snowboards to our soul, but what are we attaching? I believe that what you feed your soul does direct you in life. In fact, it may be the biggest contributor to what you think and feel, your perceptions of what is around you. Consider your soul as a receptacle, and over the course of your lifetime, you are feeding it a certain diet. So it grows in the direction of the nutrition that you give it. And I believe that we each educate our souls in different ways. Here's a simple example. Growing up in East Lansing, Michigan, Anthony knew he was different from other kids. Through the fifth grade, he had an aide with him in class. In middle school, he'd go to a resource classroom. And Anthony's differences affected him beyond the classroom. He loved Michigan State sports teams. His dad worked in the athletic department, but attending the games was difficult. The crowd noises, the horns from the scoreboard were too much for him as an autistic young man. Anthony also had a hard time understanding jokes and sarcasm. He took everything literally. So, for example, if somebody had told the five-year-old me that it's raining cats and dogs outside, he said, I would go outside and hope that a cat or dog would fall into my arms. Well, bullies targeted Anthony in school. He says it didn't help that he was bigger and taller than pretty much everyone at school. When I started off in sixth grade, I was 6 feet tall with size 13 shoe, he says. And you know, people called me many names like the Jolly Green Giant. And it drove me crazy to the point where I was on the floor crying and just telling people to stop. Well, after Anthony finished middle school, he learned something that helped this all make a bit more sense. Going into my freshman year of high school, my parents sat me down in the living room while my dad looked at me and said, "Son, we have to tell you a little story," Anthony recalls. So they told me the story about my diagnosis. At 4 years old, Anthony had been diagnosed with pervasive development disorder, which Anthony describes as higher functioning form of autism, along the same lines as Asperger's syndrome. Anthony also learned that doctors and experts had told his parents not to expect much from him. They didn't think he would graduate from high school or go on to college. "Let's go shut those people up," he remembers thinking. "Let's go prove these doctors and experts wrong. Let's show them why you're not going to be in a group institution." And so I kind of had this checklist in my head: graduate from high school, get a full ride scholarship somewhere, and then graduate from college. Well, as a freshman at Okemos High School near East Lansing, Anthony was 6'6", and he loved basketball. He worked hard, got a scholarship after high school to Grand Valley State, and then transferred to Michigan State. Anthony only told the Michigan State coaches about his autism. He didn't tell the players. There, Coach Vork asked Anthony to stay after his first workout with the team. He told Anthony, "Anytime you're not certain of something, just look at me. Say something to me and I'll explain it to you. I got no problem with that." Well, on the Michigan State team was Draymond Green, who now plays for the Golden State Warriors in the NBA. And Draymond liked to joke about everything. One day he started joking in a sarcastic way that Anthony didn't understand. And the more Draymond joked, the more confused Anthony became. Soon the players, seeing Anthony's confusion, were joking even more and laughing at Anthony. Anthony exploded back. Well, the next day, Anthony was still upset. But in the meantime, the coaches had told Draymond about Anthony's diagnosis, and Draymond approached Anthony. Anthony really didn't want to talk to him. Well, Anthony says, he was just like, "You know, why didn't you tell me? Vork told me all this. Why didn't you tell me about your autism? Why didn't you tell me about it?" And Anthony responded, "Well, like with everybody else in my life, Draymond, I didn't know how you were going to react. I thought you were going to treat me differently, like everybody else that I knew in my life." And he looked at me for just like a good 10 seconds, not saying anything. And he said to me, "Well, first of all, kudos to you, because look what you've overcome in your life and look where you are now," he said. "Second of all, if you would have told me this from day one, none of this would have happened. And so, you know, it changed our relationship forever. We became not only better teammates after that, but we became better friends." Well, besides becoming just one of the 3.5% of high school basketball players to play college basketball, Anthony also married and has two young boys. He shared his story with over 400,000 students, talking about the harmful effects of bullying and understanding those with autism. Anthony would go on to graduate and now works in sports, helping people understand autism and helping kids with autism feel they have a part. In short, he has attached the purpose of helping those with autism to his soul. Anthony has educated his soul in a different way than I ever will. By experience, he's come to know true empathy for those who have autism. His soul is educated in beautiful ways that I could only hope for. Here's the point. We get the opportunity in life to educate our souls, and we can go about this life doing so in beautiful ways and ways that will inform our souls for eternity and set a course on in our life that changes who we are and how we think. So here's the question. What does your soul need at this point in your life right now? Well, one answer to that question may be found by asking yourself, what is your soul whispering to you right now? Yes, what's your soul whispering? Because I believe our souls do whisper. When you're contemplative, when you think about your best self, you get nudges of things to try, to do, and to learn. A soul whisper is an intuitive thought or idea from the deepest part of yourself. Yes, it's your inner voice or intuition that offers insights, nudges, or wisdom from a place of authenticity. It is a gentle and subtle whispering rather than shouting. It often arises in moments of quiet reflection, and these whispers may manifest as feelings, hunches, or subtle impulses. Listening is about learning to discern the quiet voice of the soul amidst the noise of everyday life and trying to follow its guidance. For example, perhaps you've been hearing whispers to go to church or join a book club or stop a bad habit or fill your life with more reading or serve at the local soup kitchen like your friend does or learn a new language or take a risk or set aside a night each week to just have fun with your kids or go back to school or whatever it is. These soul whispers come your way. So if you were to do something for your soul today, what would you do? Can I make a suggestion? Whatever it is, it doesn't have to be big. Leo Tolstoy once said, "True life is lived when tiny changes occur." Perhaps the whisper you need to follow is to be kinder to yourself, to say a prayer more often, to finally make that phone call you've been needing to make, to read the book, or any one of many small whispers that you may hear from time to time. It's by small and simple ways that big things in life happen. And here's the thing. If you believe your soul existed before you came to Earth, that it was a thinking, speaking intelligence long before you put on this earthly body, then your soul knows who you really are and knows who you're supposed to become, what you need, and what value you bring to this amazing experience we call life. I believe that our soul will whisper things that will pull us in the direction of who we're supposed to become. And this direction may be different for every one of us. It is what makes us unique. As Grandmother Tala told Moana, you may hear a voice inside, and if that voice starts to whisper to follow the farthest star, Moana, that voice inside you is who you are. And here's the thing. When you start living in the direction of these whispers, you will feel different. You will feel joy and goodness. Again, it doesn't have to be something big. As Tolstoy said, small moves. Moana might say to us, you can't ignore who you are. Follow it to the ends of the earth. Listen to your soul whispers. They are giving you the directions you need. They are a map that leads you on your journey. They bring you to your destiny. Well, perhaps one of the soul whispers coming to you is to just chill. My kids used to say this to me all the time. Dad, just chill, just relax. And I found that much of what whispers to me is to give things time. Just relax and enjoy the people around me. Enjoy the process. Enjoy seeing people grow and change. Just take a pause because time has a way of doing God's good work. And sometimes we just need to listen, be present, and be kind. When most frustrated parents deal with teenagers, they tend to forget their own teenage years. They tend to forget that a few years in their own life made all the difference. We forget that heaven's influence can take a little time. In the scripture, you know that Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness, wandering, trying to get the years of Egypt's influence out of their system. And that's what God is likely doing to us, working on the inside, helping the rising generation learn how to live dependent on Him. Time, sometimes, is the only way to get this done. Maybe your soul is whispering to find where you belong and what you are to do. Oscar Wilde said, if you know exactly what you want to be in life, you want to be a grocer or a general or politician or judge, you will invariably become it. That is your punishment. Maybe there's something your soul needs to learn by trying on a few new things to see what fits best. You know, I believe that God gives us seasons. Yes, seasons in our lives. Times in which we're to learn a particular thing or do His work in some particular way. And part of growing your soul is to figure this out. What season, what opportunity is God giving to me right now? You know, at one point in my life, I found myself with a lot of airplane time. I was traveling. I hate travel. But I soon learned that hating and reluctantly doing created a lot of anxiety. So as I looked at my situation, I realized I had a season, and it was a gift. I had excess time. So I always wanted to get a PhD, and now I had study time. I convinced a local university program to work with me, and I used those flight hours to get a degree. God gives us seasons to see what we will do with them. And it's likely your soul is prompting you to take advantage of this season God is giving to you. When I was a young man, the movie Footloose was released by Paramount Pictures. Dean Pitchford, who won an Academy Award for the movie Fame, came up with the idea and wrote the screenplay. It was about a high school boy named Ren McCormick who moves from Chicago to a small town, and that small town was actually my small town. The flour mill where Ren worked and some of the filming was done is Lehigh Roller Mills, and that's where I worked as a young man during high school. I spent a lot of afternoons, nights, and weekends bagging flour and cleaning the mill. The small church, fields, farms, and homes used in the film were almost all in my boyhood town. In the movie, because of a car accident years earlier, the city council had placed a ban on dancing within the city limits. McCormick attempts to overturn the ban on dancing, but the city council is led by Reverend Shaw Moore, who wields great influence amongst the citizens. Well, Ren strikes up a friendship with the reverend's daughter, and together they engage in a strategy to overturn the ban on dancing in the town. At one point in the story, Ariel, the reverend's daughter, and her mother pass on to McCormick several Bible verses that demonstrate the approval of God to dance. The reverend recognizes the help Ren receives, and eventually the dance is held at the flour mill where I worked, and the teenagers in the town are footloose in their celebration. In the film, one of the scriptures used by Ren McCormick to persuade the city council was Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 4, which reads, "To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to harvest, a time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance." This is a profound scripture that I believe is true. There are times appointed and seasons appointed to us and to our souls in our life. And at times we must plant, and at other times we must harvest. Yes, we should dance. Your soul needs to dance from time to time. Feeding your soul is like tending to a garden. It requires patience, care, and attention. It's about seeking out experiences that enrich your spirit, whether through moments of quiet reflection, acts of kindness, or connections with others. Like a garden, your soul flourishes when it receives the right balance of light, love, and attention. So, tend to your soul with tenderness and intention, and watch. You will find your soul purpose in life. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend. And join us next week as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.